Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Panzergunner, From My Native Canada to the German Ostfront and Back, in action with 25th Panzer Regiment, 7th Panzer Division, 1944-45, by Bruno Friesen, narrated by David DeVries. Forward. In 1950, after my 11-year exile in Europe, I had been back in Canada for only a few weeks when Ted Nettleton, the middle-aged personnel manager at the B.F. Goodrich tire plant on King Street West in Kitchener, Ontario, mentioned to me that a certain old sea captain was known to say, "Don't tell people your troubles. Half of them don't care, and the other half are glad of them." My employment interview at Goodrich must have revealed that I was greatly concerned because a lot of my fellow citizens looked askance at me for having served in the enemy armed forces during part of the Second World War, and that I had years of catching up on formal schooling ahead of me. From 1950 to 1993, I, heeding the cautionary advice given to me by Ted Nettleton, rarely disclosed that I had been sent to Germany in 1939 and that I had been forced to live outside of Canada continuously for well over a decade. In 1994, however, with the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Europe just ahead, I decided to divulge some of my overseas experiences. I first describe in this book of mine what it was I believe that got me from Canada to Germany in 1939. I then relate how I fared in Germany before I joined the Wehrmacht on November 1, 1942. Thereupon, I present, chronologically, stories of some of my adventures as a German soldier before May 7, 1945. These chapters I regard as the book's core. Thereafter, I write about my post-war jobs in Germany and my long-delayed return to Canada. The following subsequent milestones in my life fall within the scope of the book: employment at B.F. Goodrich Canada Limited, marriage to Helga Meyer in Waterloo, Ontario in 1951, 10 years of advanced technical evening classes yielding for me ATEC Certificates 1, 2, and 3 issued by the Ontario Department of Education and registration as a certified engineering technologist, 5.5 years of full-time studies at university, resulting in the degrees of Bachelor of Arts, Master of Arts, English, and Master of Philosophy, English. 19 years of teaching English at an Ontario College of Applied Arts and Technology, retirement at age 65 in 1990, and volunteer work at the Canadian War Museum. My occasional use of German in the stories is calculated to impart to them greater realism, as well as, quite possibly, to afford the reader glimpses into the mentalities of the characters, something purely unilingual stories based on such subject matter would do to a much lesser extent. Of course, the reader may elect to dispense with the German and rely entirely on the translations. Among my documents used, all of them uncommon, are the pocket-size one-page battle line avowal of the soldiers of the 7th Panzer Division, a document from late 1944 or early 1945, so rare that the divisional history, published in 1986, makes no mention of it. Although I have not had to rely on archival support for my stories, I have consulted the following book repeatedly: General der Panzertruppe, A.D., retired, Hasso E. von Manteuffel, der 7. Panzerdivision im Zweiten Weltkrieg, Einsatz und Kampf der Gespensterdivision, Friedberg, Potsdam Palace Verlag, 1986. Using only the translation of its title, henceforth I refer to the above book as the 7th Panzer Division in World War II, mostly in documenting my translations of passages from Manteuffel's original. It is not to be confused with Manteuffel's English language, the 7th Panzer Division, an illustrated history of Rommel's Ghost Division, 1938-1945. Chapter 1. Shipped Out to Germany. Thousands of times I have been asked, "What made you go back to Germany?" Thousands of times I have replied, "I didn't go back. I was born in Canada and had never been to Germany." In March 1939, 2 months before my 14th birthday, I was yanked out of Sudeby Public School on Frederick Street in Kitchener, Ontario, and together with my brother Oscar, who was 1.5 years younger than I, and 3 other youngsters from Kitchener, was put on a train to New York. There, the 5 of us boarded the express steamer Europa for the voyage to Bremerhaven in Germany. Making travel preparations for Kitchener for Oscar and I had not amounted to much more than hurriedly and quietly getting together our Canadian passports and our free tickets. That brief spell had elapsed without our being given any reason for our having to leave Canada, or for that matter, for our having to maintain silence regarding our impending departure. Often I have wanted to fathom why, surrounded by secrecy, Oscar and I were shipped out to Germany almost 70 years ago. My father, a stationary engineer at Forsyth's shirt factory in Kitchener at the time, would read well-circulated copies of various German illustrated periodicals, that I knew. He would, I also knew, drop in after work at Colerco's fruit and vegetable store near the City Hall in Kitchener, and, I suppose, have a chat with Signor Colarco about Axis developments. Yes, my father was pro-German, but I have to look far beyond Colarco's counter to explain, if I can, what it was that made him and my mother decide to send Oscar and me to Germany. Having arrived in Canada from the Ukraine in 1924, my parents, please consult the relevant maps for the location of the district in the Ukraine from which they hailed, after working for almost a year on a Pennsylvania Dutch Mennonite farm near Waterloo, Ontario, moved to the Portage-la-Prairie district of Manitoba. The Canadian Pacific Railway had advanced many Mennonite immigrants the money for their fares to Canada under the condition that they settle on lands adjacent to CPR tracks. I was born on Section 113-9 in Westbourne Municipality on May 25, 1925, and was just old enough to start school in Waterloo after my parents had abandoned their land at Westbourne and returned to Ontario. In Manitoba, they had tried in vain to farm 160 acres, part of an agriculturally inferior tract bought by 10 families while it lay under snow. Annually, widespread spring flooding prevented the timely seeding of practically all of that expanse. Among all Mennonites burdened by it, the CPR loan was referred to as our travel debt, and for them, that debt remained, for years, a financial millstone. The Great Depression, of course, was the primary cause of so much misery. It robbed my father of any hope that he might emerge debt-free in Canada. My parents had never been to Germany. Neither had my grand, great-grand, or great-great-grandparents. However, because of their first language, German, all of them had maintained strong cultural and economic ties with Germany. The German-speaking population of the Mennonite colonies in the Ukraine had for decades mail-ordered their agricultural machinery, their reading material, and starting in the early 1900s, even their automobiles from Germany. In Soviet armor ambushed at the lake at Lessen in West Prussia, one of my following stories, I refer in detail to some of my forebears' strong traditional German ties. Before we moved to Kitchener in 1937, we lived at 132 King Street South in Waterloo. Every Saturday evening, a coterie of Mennonites, including my parents, would congregate at 132. A polyglot bunch they constituted, speaking High German, Low German, Russian, Ukrainian, and some English. High German is the official language in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Low German, or Plattdeutsch, Platt is German for flat, is the informal German spoken in flat or lowland northern Germany. Every letter from relatives or friends in the old country that did get through to the group in those hard times was neatly written in High German, no matter how low-grade the stationery, as was every letter of response. On Saturday mornings, the WK, or Waterloo-Kitchener United Mennonite Church on George Street in Waterloo, conducted its one-room German school in the church basement. I acknowledge that during my early months in Germany, I made good use of most of the rather rudimentary German I had learned at WK. However, it turned out that the unworldliness of the school's one level of textbook, strengthened by the school's one instructor, a straight-laced lady from a fine Russian Mennonite family, had left me incapable of inquiring in refined German where the next toilet was. In 1985, about 50 years after I last attended German classes at WK, the surviving members of the family of a former custodian of the German school's textbooks presented me with the book I had used on at least one Saturday morning so very long ago. It was mine, all right, so to speak, for it bears my full name and what was then our address scribbled boyishly onto the inside of its back cover. This old book in itself attests to the Russian Mennonites' faithfulness to the German language. Its full title is Deutsches Lesebuch für Volksschulen in Russland, German Reader for Primary Schools in Russia. Published in 1919 by Gottlieb Schaab in Prishib, a town adjacent to the northwestern corner of the Molochna, one of the oldest Mennonite colonies in the Ukraine, it is one of a dozen or so identical copies that were used for years at WK, and would have been brought to Canada from Russia, probably in the early 1920s, by persons to whom the German language meant a great deal. In my own modest library, there reposes, next to the reader I have just referred to, a book entitled Poems of Nikolaus Lenau. It has an embossed spine and covers and was published in 1877 in Stuttgart in Germany. My annotation on the inside of the front cover reads as follows. Received as a gift from father at the main railway station in Wilhelmshaven before I left for Canada. This book, one of a large trunkful that my father had taken with him from the Ukraine to Canada and from Canada to Germany, signified his love of literature. I am certain that he cherished this particular book more than many of his others. Nikolaus Lenau is the pen name of Niemsch Edler von Strelenau, 1802-50. As a resident of Hungary, Lenau chose his subject matter largely from outside of Germany. It is not surprising that my father displayed a great affinity for Lenau's work. Throughout most of his adult life, my father wrote many poems and much prose, all under the pseudonym Fritz Senn. I have a 311-page book published in Winnipeg in 1987 after his death and entitled Fritz Senn, Collected Poems and Prose. Much of his writing reveals his intense nostalgia for his beloved Mennonite world in the Ukraine. My mother often related that as a single young man in the Ukraine, our paterfamilias had spent much time with his books. He was, she emphasized, the youngest of nine children in a well-to-do family, and he hadn't been expected to work hard. That, she said, had left him with a lot of time for literary studies. Probably contributing to my father's pro-German stance was the fact that, starting in 1917, he was, for a few years, a member of the Mennonite Self-Defense Organization, a paramilitary cavalry established to protect the affluent Mennonite colonies in the Ukraine from the infamous Machno's bandits. This defense organization was trained briefly by German officers and non-commissioned officers. Many purely pacifistic Mennonites condemned those of their brethren who fought the anarchistic forces. By early 1939, my father's ideas concerning emigration from Canada to Germany had become solidified, largely because of the influence of the Confederation of Germans Abroad, a Third Reich-backed propagandistic organization operating in league with many of the German social clubs in North America. At the time, the Concordia Club, the Kitchener area's largest German club, had its premises above one of the two movie theaters, either the Capitol or the Lyric, on King Street West in Kitchener. On Saturday evenings, the parents, both nominal Mennonites, of the three boys who accompanied Oscar and me to Germany, would parade most, if not all, of their 10 kids close to the dance floor at the Concordia Club. Although my parents never frequented the Concordia, our family did, in the summer of 1938, attend the club's annual picnic on cow-dung-dotted Kaufman's Flats, beside the Grand River, just upstream from Kitchener. At that picnic, my father was happy to earn a few dollars extra by washing beer glasses in the vicinity of the bar in the beer tent. The occasional glass of suds, which one of the busy, perspiring bartenders handed to him in the heat under the canvas, must have constituted his bonus. Probably the Confederation was instrumental in having the train and steamship tickets for Oscar and I paid for from within Germany. In return, The recruiters involved undoubtedly hoped that they had planted boundless love for the Third Reich in the members of our family. I believe that Fritz Senn, or, if you prefer, Gerhard Johann Friesen, could not see himself as a farmer or factory worker in Canada. Germany beckoned mightily, so he sent, as the initial step in his unpublicized plan to transplant his entire family to that promised land, his first and his second born there, albeit at a very inopportune time. My mother simply consented. Oscar and I left Kitchener for New York on March 20, 1939, and sailed from there on March 22. At any rate, we five seemingly outcast boys discovered, in one of the lounges aboard the Europa, a phonograph surmounting a boy-high cabinet of polished, reddish-brown wood filled with records. Daily throughout the crossing, we had our fun, making the thing play for hours at a time. I stress our having so much fun with the phonograph because, for us, things became absolutely mirthless upon our arrival in Bremerhaven about 1 week after we left New York. My souvenir log of that Atlantic crossing by the Europa shows that she left New York on March 22, 1939, and that she passed Cherbourg, France, and Breakwater on March 27, having covered 3,128 nautical miles in 4 days, 22 hours, and 6 minutes. For the Europa to get from Cherbourg to Bremerhaven, the souvenir log also shows that she had to travel another 535 nautical miles to get there, must have prolonged our trip by about 2 days, making it 7 days. At this point, I had best introduce into my narrative 2 entire newspaper articles as well as excerpts from another 2. Published in the Kitchener Daily Record between March 16 and 24, 1939, the 4 articles are preserved on microfilm at the archives of the Record in Kitchener, Ontario. The subject microfilm reveals its age. Nevertheless, the copies made of it on my behalf by Gerhard and Kathy Friesen reflects the concerns about Nazi activity in Canada around the time of Oscar's departure and mine. Note that the Kitchener Daily Record published our names on Friday, March 24, 1939, 2 days after the Europa had sailed from New York. Jews boycott KW product. Action said result of Nazi activity throughout district. Attorney General Konitz reported investigation into alleged Nazi activity in the Twin City and district was not in evidence here today, and both city and provincial police declined to comment on the announcement. But while there was no indication that outside police were checking on the reports, several angles came to light. It was learned that Bruno and Oscar Friesen, 821 King Street East, accompanied the 4 Esau children to Germany. Police keep quiet. Indications that local business might suffer from adverse publicity, given the community, came to light when the Record was informed at least 1 manufacturer's goods were boycotted by Toronto Jews. The latter claimed they would have nothing to do with merchandise manufactured locally. I have nothing to say for publication, Sergeant W.C. Oliver of the Provincial Police told the Record. He refused to confirm or deny a report that outside police may be sent here to probe Nazi activities. Inspector Jordan, in charge of the local detachment, was out of town and could not be reached. Chapter 2. A Stranger in Deutschland. After disembarking in Bremerhaven, we were taken to Hohenkirchen, an old village about 20 kilometers northwest of Wilhelmshaven, the naval city on the North Sea coast. The District Association of Farmers had 6 farmers, their large NSDAP, Nazi, membership badges in evidence. Seated at one end of the long table in the Hohenkirchen council chamber, grouped at the other end of the same table, we boys awaited our fate. How who got whom, I do not know. The farmers might as well have thrown the dice to arrive at some kind of distribution. What I do know is that I was assigned to Gerhard Eben, pronounced Eben of Karlsek, a hamlet something like 4 kilometers northwest of Hohenkirchen and within sight of the North Sea dike. Promptly, the stern-faced lady of the Ebenhaus, bent on finding out how much German I knew not, asked me to read the name of their weekly newspaper. Because the J and the F in Gothic type look very much alike, I read aloud, "Pfäffisches Wochenblatt." I should have read, "Jäfisches Wochenblatt." At that, the entire family guffawed. Present were the Ebens' two daughters, both of whom attended high school in Jever, the district capital 16 kilometers west-northwest of Wilhelmshaven. A day or two after my arrival in Karlsruhe, I was handed an oversized Piesava broom and told to remove the thick moss covering an entire wall of one of the brick buildings. As I attacked the moss, a couple of middle-aged sightseers with horse and buggy drove up. Reins in hand, the nosy rustic said to his equally nosy wife, "Dat is Gerd's in Americana." That is Gerhard's American. In addition to sounding a lot like a reference to my being regarded as the Eben's chattel, those words showed the locals' ignorance of the existence of Canada. Every visitor who came to the Ebens specifically to behold the Americana had to agree with the master of the house's pronouncement that Germany had saved a young lad of German blood from degenerate life in America. What could I say? Had my parents not sent me to Deutschland? Upjever, near Jever, at the time had a military airfield which still exists for the Bundeswehr, successor to the Wehrmacht. In 1939, planes from Upjever sometimes practiced low-level flying over the fields at places like Karlsruhe, just about scaring the yokels on the ground into deep, water-filled ditches. When there was once talk at the table of half the tribe having been buzzed by two flying machines stationed at Upjever, I mentioned that in Canada, we boys had fashioned model aircraft from balsa wood, using twisted rubber bands as motive power for their propellers. "Impossible," the Ebens and whoever else was there blurted out. "I should," they scolded, "stick to the truth, and not talk about planes in America. Instead, I should talk about the planes at Upjever, real, live German military aircraft. In every respect, Deutschland, Deutschland above all else governed the thinking of the ignorant, humiliating bastards that the word Karlsruhe stood for." Less than half a year later, I was no longer confined to performing tasks like trying to rid a brick wall of stubborn, centimeter-thick moss. During harvest time in 1939, for instance, I carried many sacks full of heavy grain from the threshing machine, up a ladder, not up any stairs, and into the granary, actually the attic above the family's living quarters. I served as the family's underprivileged junior hired man. Their senior hired man, a good enough chap by the name of Gerd Brandt, volunteered for the German infantry to get away from Karlsruhe. My room was what is called an aftermost, or back kitchen, a small place adjacent to the upper end of the long cattle stable. I say upper end because the stable was built on a slight incline to facilitate partial drainage toward its lower end, one of the excrement gutters situated immediately behind the rows of cattle. Crudely fashioned, by means of four thumbtacks to the inside of the gray wooden door of my uncomfortable abode, hung a magazine clipping showing the black-and-white copy of a portrait of Adolf, and, in the margin below, his likeness, his telling signature consisting of a snippet of Adolf, followed by a downsloping, tornado-like vortex representing Hitler. My wash water I usually fetched, at least in the frost-free months of the year, a pail full at a time from the frog-infested, moat-like ditch almost surrounding the farm's clustered buildings. Home, sweet home. Once every week, I was a foreigner living in what was called a border area. I had to walk to the police station in Hohenkirchen, report to the police, and walk back to the farm. If I was lucky, I would meet one or two of the Canadians at or near the police station. They, too, had to show up there in person. Upon returning to the farm at Karlsruhe, I would, without fail, be quizzed about what I had observed along the way. How is so-and-so's oats coming along, and how many head of cattle are grazing on his land? Gone for good, I knew, was the old neighborhood gang back in Canada. Gone were the roller skates in summer. Gone was the Albert Street Hill in Kitchener, Our ski and toboggan hill with the synagogue and the city's water tower at its apex, and Rumpel's Bush at the bottom of its eastern slope. Gone was so much. Gone abruptly was my childhood. Surprise! A few weeks before the outbreak of Second World War, my parents, with the rest of their kids, three of them, all Canadian-born, made it to Germany, to Wilhelmshaven, to be exact. The apartment assigned to them was on the ground floor of a First World War-era walk-up on Kasernenstrasse, a short street with Rundstrasse and its immense Kriegsmarine barracks opposite its one end, and the high, barbed-wire-topped brick wall of the submarine base opposite its other. Half a dozen blocks north of Kasernenstrasse towered one of the city's landmarks, the Kaiser Wilhelm Bridge, also called KW Brücke, with the KW as in Kitchener-Waterloo. Still in operation, this old swing bridge connects the city with the commercial beach, the location of, for instance, the Seawater Aquarium. In the walk-up, the toilets, not the bathrooms, because there weren't any, for all of the apartments were off the stairway landings between the floors. Not only that, next to each toilet door was the coin-operated gas meter for the corresponding apartment. One had to feed one's meter frequently, and on time, or it would, without warning, shut off the gas. On the far side of Kasernenstrasse, Emmy Zeile, a spinster, operated a small grocery store. Emmy wanted the new family on the street to have a treat, so she sold my mother some Roquefort. Not knowing that Roquefort contained veins of mold, my father thought that the cheese was spoiled. He exclaimed, "Die meint wohl, wir essen im Dunkeln." She must think that we eat in the dark. Their table in Canada, and before that, in the Ukraine, had hardly seen the delicacies that were common in Western Europe. We, my parents included, were learning many things daily. My father was soon introduced by the NSDAP, Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, or Nazi Party, to his first German place of employment, an electrical business owned by Julius Harms, a master electrician and politically well-connected bigwig, whose wife Amanda had, I later learned, been a cocktail hostess in her younger years. Julius's business premises were located on Marktstrasse, in the heart of Wilhelmshaven. The new employee at Harms' little empire was known as the store's administrator. Rolls, large and small, of various gauges of electrical wire, untold numbers of diverse fasteners, ladders of different length, special tools, that sort of treasure my father administered. When the old man, that's a term we boys had often used in Canada, visited me at Karlsek, his jaw dropped. He soon took the train back to Wilhelmshaven and enlisted the help of the city's political boss, Kreisleiter, district political leader Meyer, to secure my release from the Ebens. Meyer, who seemed to be endowed with humanitarian qualities, promised to have the old man's two boys join the family in Wilhelmshaven. Oscar was in servitude on a farm at Carolinensiel, down the North Sea coast, just west of Hohenkirchen. In the tightly organized NSDAP, every Kreisleiter, subordinate to his Gauleiter, political leader of a province, was in charge of the following classes of functionaries: Ortsgruppenleiter, political leader of a ward in a city or of a county; Zellenleiter, political leader of a part of a city ward or county; and Blockleiter, political warden of a block. Blockleiter abounded in a large city like Wilhelmshaven. Even Kreisleiter Meyer was unable to take me away from Karlsek without coming up with a very good reason for my switch from the country to the city. The solution? A genuine, old-fashioned apprenticeship for me. Still, it took another 6 months before I had Julius Harms as my master, or before he had me as one of his three apprentices, learning the trade of electrician. Once again, I had no say in what was happening to me. Suddenly, I had an indenture binding me to 3 years, from April 26, 1940, to April 25, 1943, of good behavior, hard work, regular attendance of the trade school, and barely any pay. During the first year, 3 Reichsmark per week. During the second year, 4 Reichsmark per week. And during the third year, 5 Reichsmark per week. Figuratively speaking, 1 Reichsmark equaled $1 at the time. Payday was each Saturday. After the driveway, the yard, and the warehouse at Marktstrasse 39 had been swept clean by noon. The stipulation that I attend Hitler Youth Service as part of my apprenticeship appeared in typing under the printed heading Besondere Bestimmungen, Special Conditions, on the last of the four legal-sized pages that constituted my...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?